Layer 753, 1944 election campaign and FDR's health interactive. The text panel reads, "All that is within me cries out to go back to my home on the Hudson River, to avoid public responsibilities, and to avoid also the publicity which in our democracy follows every step of the nation's chief executive." Franklin Roosevelt, letter agreeing to accept a nomination for a fourth term, July 11, 1944. Though ill and wearied by the burdens of leadership, FDR felt a duty to seek re-election in 1944. The contest was the first wartime presidential election since the Civil War. It unfolded as American forces engaged in increasingly costly fighting. Roosevelt overcame a nomination challenge from Southern Democrats, angry with his racial policies, who rallied around Virginia Senator Harry Byrd. But there was significant opposition within the party to Vice President Henry Wallace. Wallace was popular with liberals, but moderates and conservatives lobbied FDR to replace him. They were motivated in part by concerns about Roosevelt's health. Insiders recognized he was ill and might not survive another full term. Eventually, Roosevelt accepted Senator Harry Truman, a moderate from Missouri, as his running mate. New York Governor Thomas Dewey, the Republicans' 48-year-old presidential candidate, tried to make an issue of FDR's age and health, but Roosevelt defused it with a strenuous late campaign tour. In November, he won a comfortable victory. Text within the interactive touchscreen exhibit discusses FDR's health. It explains, "During the 1944 election, Republicans began a whispering campaign about FDR's health. The president was gravely ill, they said, and might not survive another term." FDR diffused this speculation with an energetic burst of late campaigning, but the rumors were rooted in fact. The state of FDR's health during the last years of his life has been the subject of considerable historical investigation and debate in recent decades. The Touchscreen Interactive explores the historical debate and key documents regarding FDR's health from the FDR Library collections. FDR's health. The state of FDR's health during the last years of his life has been the subject of considerable historical investigation and debate in recent decades. The president's medical records were closely guarded during his lifetime, and surviving documentation is incomplete. But it is clear that he began experiencing persistent high blood pressure around 1940. Eventually, he developed severe hypertension and an enlarged heart. Beginning in late 1943, his health declined noticeably. Roosevelt's personal physician, Rear Admiral Ross McIntyre, Surgeon General of the Navy, was an ear, nose, and throat specialist. He did not recognize the nature of the president's illness. FDR's heart disease remained undiagnosed until his daughter, Anna, became concerned and arranged to have him examined on March 27, 1944, by Dr. Howard Bruin, a young Navy cardiologist. Bruin made an immediate diagnosis and had the president placed on a regimen that included a low-fat diet, digitalis, and weight reduction. Drugs to reduce blood pressure were not available at that time. To ease the stress on his heart and address his growing fatigue, FDR's doctors eventually had him limit his working day to 2 to 4 hours. FDR's declining health has led to speculation that he ran for re-election in 1944, knowing he might not survive a fourth term. Some critics even argue that Stalin took advantage of an ailing president at the Yalta Conference to secure control of Eastern Europe. Most historians maintain FDR's illness did not affect his action at Yalta. He did suffer from extreme fatigue, but he remained mentally alert until the end of his life. The following screens contain reproductions of selected documents from the FDR Library and excerpts of the historical debate that relate to FDR's health. You may continue listening to these quotes or press the right arrow key on your audio tour player to exit this layer of information and continue with the rest of the tour. Document 1, title, Examination Report by Dr. Howard Bruin, date, March 27, 1944. Caption: Shortly after returning to Washington from the Tehran Conference in December 1943, FDR developed a racking cough and fatigue that would not go away. He began to lose weight. Eleanor Roosevelt became concerned, and she alerted the White House physician and Surgeon General, Vice Admiral Ross T. McIntyre. But McIntyre was an ear, nose, and throat specialist whose chief tasks were to relieve the president's almost constant sinus trouble and to be good company. The Roosevelt's daughter, Anna, demanded that McIntyre schedule a thorough examination of the president. McIntyre arranged for Roosevelt to go to Bethesda Naval Hospital on March 27, 1944, and he selected cardiologist Dr. Howard Bruin to do the examination. It revealed that FDR suffered from reduced lung capacity, high blood pressure, acute bronchitis, and congestive heart failure. In this report to Bethesda's commanding officer, Captain John Harper, Bruin describes the results of the exam and recommends a period of rest, the use of digitalis to regulate the heart rhythm, dietary changes, and sedated sleep. Citation, Howard Bruin Papers, FDR Medical Information, Box 1. Document 2, title, FDR's Blood Pressure Record, date, April 9th to May 1st, 1944. Caption, Dr. Bruin's diagnosis of congestive heart failure alarmed Admiral McIntyre, the Surgeon General. He quickly organized the March 29, 1944 conference of highly respected specialists to review Bruin's findings. This group included Dr. James Paulin of Atlanta, Dr. Frank Leahy of the Leahy Clinic in Boston, and Captain Harper, Bethesda's commanding officer. Paulin and Leahy examined the president themselves later that day. Although FDR's condition concerned them, they were not convinced that his heart issues were as severe as Bruin asserted. Bruin refused to alter his diagnosis. He was then assigned to serve as the president's personal physician. On April 8th, Bruin accompanied FDR to South Carolina for a month-long rest at the estate of wealthy presidential advisor Bernard Baruch. While there, Bruin closely monitored FDR's high blood pressure. He later prepared this report. Caption, Anna Roosevelt, Halstead Papers, FDR Medical Blood Pressure Statistics, Box 66. Document 3, title, FDR's Physical Examination Report, date, May 10, 1944. Caption, during his 4 weeks in South Carolina, FDR was kept to a very limited schedule. When he arrived, he said, I want to sleep and sleep 12 hours every night. The president remained in close touch with the White House and his military advisors, but all his other activities were severely reduced. He recovered sufficiently to go fishing a few days before the end of the trip. Shortly after returning to the White House, FDR was once again examined by a team of doctors. This examination report, prepared by Admiral McIntyre, appeared to demonstrate that FDR had regained his health. But in reality, the president's blood pressure remained alarmingly high, averaging 196 over 112 in the morning and 194 over 96 in the evening. Caption, Ross T. McIntyre's papers, Collier's article Unconquerable Spirit, Letters, 1946, Box 2. Document 4, title, FDR's Treatment Plan, date, May 1944. Caption, today, high blood pressure, or hypertension, is treated with medication. But in 1944, medications had not yet been developed to control hypertension. The only treatment then available was to regulate the external factors that affected blood pressure, including the amount of stress and activity, diet, and tobacco use. The president's work schedule was reduced to 4 hours in the office per day, preferably with no irritation. Regular rests and quiet meals were also prescribed. He was forbidden to swim in the White House pool and required to reduce his drinking and smoking. Citation, Anna Roosevelt Halsted Papers, FDR Medical, Treatment and Medication, Box 66. Document 5, title, The President's Daily Routine, date, May 5, 1944. Caption, the treatment plan, reducing the president's activities, was fleshed out in greater detail into a daily schedule that his doctors insisted he follow closely. His day started with breakfast in bed in his White House bedroom. He then went to the Oval Office for 2 hours of work. After lunch in his White House quarters, he rested in bed and then returned to the Oval Office for an additional 2 hours before ending his day with a massage, another rest, and dinner in his quarters. Evening work was prohibited, and 10 hours of sleep was prescribed. So in May 1944, 1 month before the D-Day invasion, the President of the United States was limited to 4 hours of work per day. Citation, Ross T. McIntyre Papers, Collier's article, Unconquerable Spirit, Letters, 1946, Box 2. Document 6, title, Diet for the President, date, September 9th, 1944. Caption, much to his displeasure, the president's diet was also closely regulated. The White House cuisine was never particularly good during the Roosevelt years, and under the watchful eye of the chief housekeeper, Henrietta Nesbitt, FDR's medically regulated diet got even blander. Citation, Howard Bruin Papers, FDR Medical Information, Box 1. Document 7, title, Examination Report Summary, date, September 20th to October 4th, 1944. Caption, after living under the new schedule and dietary regime for several months, a new round of examinations by a group of Bethesda doctors, including Dr. Bruin, seemed to show that FDR was responding well. In this summary, prepared by Surgeon General McIntyre, FDR's blood pressure averages had lowered, and there appeared to be no cardiac symptoms at any time. But a comment in the report that the patient was underweight was an understatement. FDR had lost 30 pounds since March, and he could not regain it. The likely cause of the weight loss was cardiac cachexia, a condition associated with congestive heart failure, but some authors have asserted that the cause may have been abdominal cancer resulting from untreated melanoma. Citation, Ross T. McIntyre Papers, Collier's article, Unconquerable Spirit, Letters, 1946, Box 2. Document 8, title, FDR Accepting the 1944 Democratic Nomination, date, July 20th, 1944. Caption, there was no question that Roosevelt would run for a fourth term in 1944. FDR believed that he had a duty to see the war through to the end, but it was clear to several leading Democratic politicians that Roosevelt was ill, and the question of his running mate became a hotly contested issue. Indeed, in early July 1944, Dr. Frank Leahy, a highly respected internist from Boston who had been part of the group that examined FDR in March, advised Surgeon General McIntyre that he believed the president would not survive another full term in office. FDR did not attend the 1944 Democratic Convention in Chicago, but before departing Washington on a trip to California and Hawaii, he advised the convention chairman of his willingness to accept Senator Harry Truman as a running mate in place of Henry Wallace. On July 20, 1944, FDR accepted the nomination in a radio address delivered from his train car in San Diego. The picture that appeared in the next day's newspapers horrified the White House because it showed a thin, slack-jawed FDR. The image fed the rumors beginning to circulate about the president's health. Citation, FDR Library Photograph Collection, FDR, July 1944. Document 9. Title, Letter to FDR from Interior Secretary Harold Ickes. Date, July 3, 1944. Caption, the president's noticeable weight loss and schedule changes led to rumors about his health in the press and political circles. Surgeon General McIntyre continued to insist that the president was in good health, although suffering from periodic bouts of sinusitis, bronchitis, influenza, and other common maladies that he could not shake. As the 1944 campaign season got underway, the health rumors provided fodder for FDR's political opponents. A whispering campaign began to circulate that FDR was a sick, tired old man who could not govern the nation or lead the war. FDR's 1944 Republican opponent, Governor Thomas E. Dewey of New York, expanded the tired old man line of attack to include all of those in FDR's inner circle. In this letter to FDR, Interior Secretary Harold Ickes suggests ways to counter Dewey's attacks. Citation, Official File 3850, Thomas E. Dewey. Document 10, title, New York City Police Department Schedule of FDR's Campaign Tour. Date, October 20th, 1944. Caption, as the whispering campaign about FDR's health began to gain traction, it became imperative that the president show the country he was still vigorous and effective. In September, Roosevelt delivered his famous Fallah speech, demonstrating that he still had his old campaign magic. On October 20th, 1944, FDR toured New York City in an open car amid a cold driving rain. Thousands of people lined the streets to see the president. Along the way, he delivered an outdoor campaign speech at Brooklyn's Ebbets Field, after which he was stripped down, warmed up, and dressed in a dry set of clothes. The open car tour then continued. That night, FDR delivered a major foreign policy address at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. Additional appearances in Philadelphia, Chicago, and Boston showed the nation that he could still hold up to the strains of a campaign and therefore the presidency. Citation, U.S. Secret Service Records, 103-1, Protection of the President, New York, October 1944, Box 6. Document 11, title, FDR on his final campaign tour of the Hudson Valley. Date, November 6, 1944. Caption, following a tradition established in 1932, FDR ended the 1944 presidential campaign with a final tour of his beloved Hudson River Valley. With his Treasury Secretary, friend, and fellow Dutchess County resident, Henry Morgenthau, Jr., Roosevelt drove throughout the Hudson Valley on November 6th, waving to his neighbors. He stopped now and then to visit and shake hands with familiar figures. That night, he addressed the nation from his home in Hyde Park. Tomorrow, you, the people of the United States, again vote as free men and women, with full freedom and choice, with no secret police watching over you. And for generations to come, Americans will continue to prove their faith in free elections. The next day, Franklin Roosevelt was elected to his fourth term. Citation, FDR Library Photograph Collection, FDR, November 1944. Document 12, title, Diary of Presidential Secretary William D. Hassett. Date, March 30th, 1945. Caption, FDR returned from the 14,000-mile trip to the Yalta Conference on February 28, 1945. The next day, he appeared before a joint session of Congress to report on the conference. His delivery of the speech was erratic, and he made frequent, rambling departures from the written text. The president remained in Washington until March 24th, when he went home to Hyde Park for a few days. He returned to Washington on March 29th for a day, and then continued on to Warm Springs. Everyone hoped that Warm Springs would rejuvenate the president, as it had always done before. But FDR's traveling secretary, William D. Hassett, grew increasingly worried about the president's condition. Hassett pulled Dr. Bruin aside to express his concerns, which he later recorded in his diary. He is slipping away, and no earthly power can keep him here. To all the staff, to the family, and with the boss himself, I have maintained the bluff, but I am convinced that there is no help for him. Citation, William D. Hassett, Papers, Diary, December 20th, 1944 through May 13th, 1945, Box 22. Document 13. Title: Dr. Howard Bruin's Examination Report of FDR's Last Day. Date: April 12, 1945. Caption: Dr. Bruin examined FDR shortly after the president woke up on April 12, 1945. With the exception of a slight headache and neck stiffness, he seemed in a chipper and talkative mood. After dressing FDR, the president's valet wheeled him out of the bedroom of the Little White House, and Roosevelt greeted his guests, his cousin, Margaret Daisy Suckley, and Laura Delano, Lucy Mercer Rutherford, and the portrait artist Elizabeth Shumatoff. While posing for Shumatoff, FDR worked with Secretary William Hassett on the day's mail and paperwork. Shortly after 1 p.m., FDR complained of a terrific headache and slumped in his chair. Dr. Bruin was called immediately to the cottage and remained with the president until his death at 3:35. He recorded his observations in this report. Caption: Howard Bruin Papers, Clinical Notes on Illness and Death of President Roosevelt, Box 1. FDR's health book quotes Vice Admiral Ross T. McIntyre, Surgeon General of the Navy, White House physician, G.P. Putnam's Sons, 1946, pages 14 through 17. I am judged as having deliberately deceived the people of the United States by the issuance of statements that the president was sound organically and in fairly good health. In the 1944 campaign, when lost weight, thinning hair, and heavily furrowed face all too plainly showed the toll taken by crowded years, rumors as to FDR's condition revived and had the sweep of a prairie fire. It became common knowledge, according to wagging tongues, that the president had suffered a paralytic stroke, that he was being treated for cancer of the prostate, that he was the victim of a mental breakdown, and, favorite whisper of all, that his heart had played out. Time and again, it was specifically asserted that he was in a hospital for some major operation, although there was never any agreement on the city. One whisper said Miami, and another Chicago. In not one of these rumors was there a grain of truth. The president never had a stroke, never had any serious heart condition, and never underwent other operations than the removal of a wen, a harmless skin growth, and the extraction of an infected tooth. Today, however, as a result of the president's sudden death, there is a growing conviction that these rumors had a base in solid fact. In 1943, 1944, and the months in 1945, just prior to his passing, checkups were frequent and exhaustive. It was on the strength of those repeated examinations made under my direction by competent specialists and on the basis of reports rendered by distinguished consultants that I issued my statements to the press in the spring and fall of 1944. They were not glowing in the sense that they painted the president as a perfect physical specimen, but a cautious judgment that he was in excellent condition for a man of his age. I stand by that judgment today without amendment or apology. Emphasis in the original. Howard G. Bruin, M.D., Clinical Notes on the Illness and Death of President Franklin D. Roosevelt, reprinted from Annals of Internal Medicine, 72:579-591, 1970. On the basis of the history, physical findings, and the few functional tests performed, it seemed apparent that some degree of congestive heart failure was present. In the case of President Franklin D. Roosevelt, rumors about the state of his health began to be bruited about as early as 1936, 9 years before his death. These speculations continued throughout the remainder of his life and rose to a crescendo of debate and uncertainty after his death. To my knowledge, no factual clinical information regarding his health and illnesses and the events leading to his death has ever been published. For the record and its accuracy, these notes are presented. The original hospital chart, in which all clinical progress notes, as well as the results of the various laboratory tests, were incorporated, was kept in the safe at the U.S. Naval Hospital, Bethesda, Maryland. After the president's death, this chart could not be found. Based on the author's examination of the president on March 27, 1944, a diagnosis was made of hypertension, hypertensive heart disease, cardiac failure, left ventricular, and acute bronchitis. These findings and their interpretation were conveyed to Surgeon General McIntyre. They had been completely unsuspected up to this time, and a memorandum of recommendations, including 1 to 2 weeks of bed rest with nursing care and treatment with digitalis, was rejected because of the exigencies and demands on the president. When I saw the president at the White House on March 28, 1944, the physical signs were essentially unchanged. On the basis of the history, physical findings, and the few functional tests performed, it seemed apparent that some degree of congestive heart failure was present, and digitalization was again suggested to the Surgeon General as an essential form of therapy. I have often wondered what turn the subsequent course of history might have taken if the modern methods of controlling hypertension had been available. Robert H. Farrell, The Dying President, Franklin D. Roosevelt, 1944 to 1945, University of Missouri Press, 1998, pages 138 and 152. There can be no doubt that President Roosevelt's last year in the White House was, physically speaking, something he should not have undertaken. With his cardiovascular disease, he was in an impossible position in which his strength was running out. Despite his intention to hold on, to continue, there was in his case no resort, no procedure that could keep him going. It is true that the president's physicians did not tell him what he was up against, even though he knew its outlines. He could have believed that his cardiovascular disease was not of the worst, that, as Bruin later put the case to a historian, the president's condition was critical but not desperate. In what might have amounted almost to a reservoir of hope, of the sort that so many ill individuals somehow managed to hold, the president mistakenly, but with the best of intentions, could have made his decision to take a fourth term. In the lack of communication that assuredly existed between McIntyre and Roosevelt could have been the cause of the tragedy in which a president of the United States held on to office far beyond the point when he should have resigned, given up, admitted that infirmity had become too great beyond his will to change. But something more was evident in the president's behavior, and it must perforce be considered. Even though to attribute such willfulness to the president is an awkward appraisal. This was that as soon as he discovered his real problem, he took steps to withhold knowledge of it from as many individuals as possible. He not merely disguised it, he suppressed it. The president knew he was ill, even if he had delusions of immortality. In his illness, his utter weariness, with a feeling that he knew best, he engaged in denials that came to appear as affirmations. They were attractive and made sense as far as they went, which was not very far. Hugh E. Evans, M.D., The Hidden Campaign, FDR's Health and the 1944 Election, M.E. Sharp, 2002, pages 119 to 120. There was ignorance, denial, a deliberate campaign of misinformation, and a level of medical treatment below what would have been provided another citizen. The medical history of Roosevelt offers paradoxes, enigmas, and conflicts which parallel and are interwoven with the larger tapestry of his presidential career. Medical judgment and advice, which would be routinely offered to virtually any other patient, even high-ranking military and civilian officers, were not provided to Roosevelt because he was the president. If a conspiracy of silence abounded, its leader was the patient. Even a poorly informed patient can lead a conspiracy of silence. When there was said to be not even a superficial inquiry by Roosevelt, no physician or informed layman felt the need to level with him regarding his diagnosis and prognosis. delayed recognition of the significance of his hypertension, noted as far back as 1937, is inexplicable. The congestive heart failure, which was unmistakable in late March 1944, was apparently overlooked for several prior weeks or even months. The only diagnosed illness that Roosevelt and McIntyre mentioned was bronchitis. Treatment of both conditions, congestive heart failure and hypertension, was delayed, and the grave prognosis was not communicated to the patient's family, designated successor, or other associates. Roosevelt's medical history, while in the office of the presidency, raises serious concerns about the role of the White House physician and the accountability of that person, as well as the quality of the care provided. Harry S. Goldsmith, M.D., A Conspiracy of Silence, The Health and Death of Franklin D. Roosevelt, Impact on History. iUniverse, Incorporated, 2007, pages 13, 120, and 172 through 173. The likelihood was very high that FDR would win the election of 1944 and die before his term was over. Medical cover-up is not a novelty in the White House. Roosevelt and some of his key medical advisors practiced such deception with such skill as to convert FDR's paralytic disability from a liability into a political asset. FDR's manipulation of public perceptions regarding his health throughout the 1930s and early 1940s made it easy for him to hide his physical condition from the media and the public, especially during the last year of his life. When Admiral McIntyre asked renowned thoracic specialist Dr. Frank Leahy to act as a surgical consultant to the president, he must have insisted that Leahy observe strict secrecy on matters pertaining to the president and his family. However, Dr. Leahy, with far-thinking astuteness, recognized the inevitability of future scrutiny of FDR's medical management. In order to show that he personally didn't wish to be involved in a cover-up of FDR's health before the election of 1944, he recorded his concerns regarding the president's health in 1944 in a personal document that has become known as the Leahy Memorandum. The simple document showed that Dr. Leahy informed Admiral McIntyre that if Roosevelt were elected president again, he did not believe FDR had the physical capacity to complete the term, and Admiral McIntyre was in complete agreement with this. There was no mention in the document that FDR had a malignant tumor. When Leahy wrote the memo, just days before the Democratic National Convention in 1944, it was almost a year before the president's death, and at that time no malignancy may have been present. However, an answer to this possibility will probably never be known. It would appear from the Leahy Memorandum that both FDR and McIntyre knew that the president was very ill. Of equal importance, Leahy emphasized the importance of FDR's choice for his vice president. Stephen Lomazow, M.D., and Eric Fetman, FDR's Deadly Secret, Public Affairs, 2009, pages 10 and 11. Cancer of the brain has very different consequences than the heart condition that Roosevelt's doctors finally, and reluctantly, acknowledged. They said he was fatigued. We assert that the president was diagnosed with a highly malignant skin cancer, melanoma, which later metastasized to his abdomen and to his brain, producing a hemorrhage that was the most probable immediate cause of his death, and that he may also have suffered from prostate cancer, whose treatment ultimately was compromised by a multitude of serious health problems. Cancer, over many years, was FDR's deadly secret. We cannot be incontrovertibly certain in our diagnosis, of course, absent an autopsy or objective confirmation from Roosevelt's still-missing medical records. Both McIntyre and Bruin repeatedly denied that the president ever had cancer. Moreover, his severe cardiovascular problems were sufficient to kill him, and likely would have done so before the end of his fourth term. But a very strong, albeit circumstantial case, based on surviving records, independent medical evidence, and reliable eyewitness reports of his condition, supports the notion that Roosevelt died of cancer. If true, this presents a profound historical revelation. Conventional wisdom has it that Roosevelt took ill in early 1944, ran for a fourth term knowing he was ill, and then suffered a rapid physical breakdown only in the last few weeks before his death, retaining his mental powers to the end. But if the melanoma scenario is correct, it means that Roosevelt, while still in his second term, knew he was most certainly doomed to die of cancer within 5 years. You will now be automatically redirected back to where you left off in the base message.